At the request of Michael, who couldn't make it, I'm forced to prelude my talk, okay? I was a little tired of the chipper talks people are giving about physics. You know, I really want to talk about the impending apocalypse that's coming to, you know, destroy the fabric of humanity. And number one, you know, I'm afraid scientifically for what's happening. But number two, I've experienced it in this pre-apocalyptic wasteland where I grew up, northern Manitoba. So this is the prelude for Michael. So why? What's the deal with northern Manitoba? Here's a map I pulled off the internet. Settlement in Manitoba in 1921, when my grandparents came from Ukraine. They had all these choices of communities to go to, with all these high population densities, 20 people and over per square mile. They're a real megalopolis, you know what I mean? So what did they do? They got on the train, they got on the boat, whatever. And apparently they settled in a place that's not even on this map, DePauw, Manitoba. It's literally, it's like less than under one person. But I don't know how that happens, you know. Like my grandparents must have been in houses like miles apart, the two of them. So anyway, that's where I grew up. And it's like a simulator for the apocalypse, you know. There's my poor parents at the, you know, seafood aisle in the grocery store. They, you know, they got to drill holes in the ice to get fish out of the lake. I mean, it's ridiculous. My lovely wife, here, Lori, wave to everybody. She came here. She's tired of me ranting about the apocalypse at home. But see, I do it for work, too. They pay me to do it. You know, we're trapping muskrats with my brother. It's like, you know, after the apocalypse, you're not going to be able to use money. You're going to have to change, you know, pelt and it's like a barter system, right? You better get used to it, man. Anyway, there's some good things. There's good things about, you know, growing up in a wasteland. The dining, you know, the delicious food that we get to eat. Like delicious moose and a nighttime buffet. Delicious daytime moose, I don't know. It's like, I don't know, man. Michael. Oh, yeah, a delicious Barrenlands caribou. This is up in the tundra in northern Manitoba. This is my favorite one. This looks really rednecky. It's my brother's farm. You know, we're getting this moose ready to butcher, and my dad watching approvingly. As you can see, as these slides progress and I get older, I grew a beard, and that's very important for this talk. Okay, so keep in mind, I now sport this exciting beard. All right, that's the prelude. I've done my job now. Michael let me off the hook. Now to serious things, the apocalypse. I mean, I don't know why you guys are laughing. It's like you didn't even read my abstract. You know? the end is literally the end is here or near. Nigh, that's the end is nigh. Okay. We have a different language in Manitoba, apparently. Just close your eyes and think of your favorite apocalypse scenarios. All the things you know from movies and reading the internet too much, right? Some things will just pop into your mind. Of course, nuclear war. God, I can't believe we're still worried about nuclear war. You know, I thought the Cold War was over. But no, you know, it's always there. It's like the specter of death hanging over our heads all the time. Oh, the asteroid, you know, whatever. It's like, it just could come at any moment. Oh, yeah. Yeah, like really. Like the flu pandemic, you know, all these sad, starvation, you know, our industrialized, you know, food distribution networks collapsing. I mean, it's I don't know about the zombie apocalypse, but global warming. You know, we're all, don't feel bad. You know, what is this? Why do people like polar bears so much, man? Let's see. Who cares? You know, I hate polar bears. They're jerks. They're following you around, you know, they want to get up in your business. They'd eat you. If a polar bear caught you, he'd eat you and everyone you love. I guarantee that. Look at this, you stop the truck, they'll get in there. They're going to like, you know, put a sandwich in the back of there and they'll eat it, man. They eat everything, they're like walking stomachs. That's why garbage is all around and all the time. I was eating in garbage dumps and stuff. I don't care if they all drown. Is this being recorded? I forget. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. But seriously, what do you see? Nuclear wars, you know, say pandemics, global warming. What unites those three things? Yeah. This one too. This one too. We're all gonna die from the asteroid. People caused them. Not me, but other people caused these things, right? These are like caused by technology somehow, right? I mean, okay, this one may be obvious. You know, in World War II, they created the bomb, right? You know, all this, the ability to feed ourselves through these global distribution networks and globalization itself, right? That's like, technology enables that somehow. Global warming, same thing, right? It's like my huge truck that I drive around everywhere is somehow contributing to global warming. You know, it's people, it's technology. And you know what's scary? There's like even other apocalypse scenarios that I haven't even thought of until I started preparing this talk. It's like I'm not paranoid enough. I had to read this document, you know, but the Oxford Future of Humanity Institute and the Global Challenges, a terrible acronym, you know. But anyway, these guys actually study what I'm calling the technocopopolypse, the technocopolypse, whatever. I made that word up, patent pending. Just got to figure out how to pronounce it. These are apocalypse scenarios that are in the future. You know, it doesn't even make sense. But they're real. This is one they identified in this study, synthetic biology. It's like, you know, maybe we synthesize different types of viruses for cancer treatment and then lose control of them somehow, right? And then this synthetic phage spreads around the world and kills us all or something like that. Uplifting. Nanotechnology. You know, we're at the realm now where we're manipulating nanoscopic, you know, objects and machines and so on. And you know, nanotechnology is so small that you need other nanotechnology to build it. And there's a danger that these things become self-replicating. So you get these self-replicating nanorobots that essentially, you know, get inside your cells and make you do strange things. Probably what happened to me. Oh, this one's my favorite. I mean, like, you know, opposite of favorite. Global systems collapse. This is like one we haven't even heard of yet. But, you know, we're so dependent on this abstracted, you know, global internet, you know, global connected banking system, governance, and all this stuff. And we don't even know how precarious this is. You know, maybe there's some instability inherent in that system that'll just collapse the whole thing at a moment's notice. We don't even know, right? The whole global system could collapse at some point. Oh, yeah. Man, I knew you were all waiting for it. Artificial intelligence. You know, Hawking's been scaring us a lot. Remember, you know, the Skynet, Terminator. You know, maybe my phone is just on the verge of turning on me. You know, I'm becoming an AI. And so all of these things are, you know, identified by, not me, by legitimate scientists, you know, who study this type of stuff, right? And so I'm just reporting their findings to you. So what do we do? You know, what do we do? Well, number one, you're like, whoa, Melko, you're completely manic here. None of this stuff's actually gonna happen, right? But really, what are the chances of any of these things happening? Is it zero? I mean, we don't seem too worried about these things, so presumably we all assume it's about 0% chance of the apocalypse, right? But what is the chances? And you know, in particular the technology-induced scenarios, right? And one of these things has been studied quite a bit. I mean, it was the first technology-enabled apocalyptic scenario, which was nuclear war. And we've had since the 50s, essentially, to study, you know, the effect that this, you know, or the chances that nuclear war might have on society, and also the effect. How many nuclear arms do we have to exchange in order to bring about nuclear winter? It's actually a very small amount. You know, back in the Cold War, people used to believe it had to be all-out war between the U.S. and Russia. But it's actually not true. The same scientists have refined their models and said that a limited nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan is enough to plunge us into nuclear winter. Like basically, you know, the Earth will become encompassed with a layer of dust, and then everything will look like northern Manitoba. Anyway, so you know, it's actually well studied in terms of its maybe cause and effect. And so you ask, like, what is the chances that it's gonna happen? It's zero. It must be zero. It's not going to happen, right? Right? You know, Putin's not going to, he doesn't have his finger on the button, really, does he? Well, it's true that in any given year, the chance of, you know, an exchange of nuclear arms is unlikely. But it's non-zero, okay? All you have to do is get a madman in power, you know. I can't think of any off the top of my head. But save me, for example. But no, just kidding. You know how much I hate polar bears. No. Anyway, So it's like every year you're flipping a coin. And if it lands tails, you blow up the world. And if it lands heads, we're fine, right? But it's not a 50-50 coin. We don't know the bias. We don't know the statistical bias of that coin. It's very hard to predict. You know, you'd have to put in all these factors, all these, you know, the way people interact and stuff, it's basically impossible to know that bias, that probability. And every year we flip that thing since essentially the first Soviet nuclear weapon test in 1949, that coin has always landed on heads. We've always been fine. We're fine. We've always been fine, right? So should we still think that the probability of nuclear apocalypse is zero? And you probably all can guess, the probability is not zero. You know, it's actually 100%. And why is it 100%? Well, it's like we're flipping this coin over and over again, and if we just flip it enough times, the chance that it'll land on tails, I forget which one's the bomb. But you know, the chance that we'll nuke ourselves, it is 100%. It's like if the coin was biased, so it's only 10% chance per year, you know, about after 10 years, of course, there's some proper statistical way to do this, it's gonna be a chance of unity, a probability of one. It's not 10%. I mean, I don't think every year we're gambling with 10%. Every year we're gambling with maybe 1%. Who knows, right? There's many nuclear states. Any one of these could be taken over by a crazy dictator at any time, right? So the lower the probability per year, all it does is change the time scale for inevitable doom. Maybe it's gonna be 10 years, maybe it's gonna be 100 years. Okay, so maybe it's not my problem. But maybe it's, you know, your kids or your grandkids' problem. And people have known this since, you know, there's been good documentation about this since the 80s. And nuclear scientists essentially study, you know, in modern ways, this continuing threat, and they try to, like, adapt these apocalypse, these sort of scenarios and probabilities. But, you know, it's essentially, any scenario, it's 100%. When is it going to occur? That's the only question we don't know. Okay, well, you could say, well, you know, maybe we're going to get our act together with nuclear weapons and stabilize ourselves. But each one of these scenarios has a similar bias or something, right? Once we let the genie out of the bottle, once we make these, I don't know why we would make them look like this, but once we make them like this, there's some probability that we're going to lose control of those things, right? And I think, honestly, to be serious, this sort of global systems collapse is the one that we don't understand at all. We're really dependent on this global interconnected system, and we really don't understand how stable this thing actually is. So it's not like we just have the bomb. We have all these other things to worry about, right? Okay, God, now we're all sad and quiet, you know. But here's the uplifting part. What can we do to stop this, right? Well, it's like we got to stop playing that game. We got to stop flipping that coin, right? The coin still exists, but let's just stop flipping it. And that's basically what CG is going to do, right? They're gonna unite the world, and we're going to be, you know, have logical governance. You know, I challenge anyone to find a logical government in the world somehow. Cultural innovation, you know, really what it is, maybe we have to sort of erase competition. We have to maybe reduce the population. I don't know. We have to all accept a much more equal sort of way of living. We have to get rid of these striated incomes and all this stuff. This is like hippie stuff, right? It's all hippie stuff. Okay, we're not at CG, man. This is Perimeter. We're gonna solve this problem with new technologies. Just like in the 90s, everyone was going around stabbing each other with knives, and then the Rotato came out, remember? And you could put your potato on this thing, and like the peel would come off. And the new technology fixed the problem with the old, and now none of us have knives in our kitchen. You know, that's our approach, okay? And, you know, it seems insane, but really that's what we're trying to do, man. We're trying to fix technology with technology. And Homer put it, you know, he was talking about liquor, but it's the same thing, right? It's like the cause of all our problems, and we're all hoping that it's gonna be the solution. So I don't know why it would be, but let's go forward under this premise. Okay. Part two, you know, what is the solution? Okay, so we have all sorts of different, I guess, scenarios for things that could happen. And the idea is that, okay, we're not gonna change the fabric of society so that we all start getting along, but maybe we're gonna be able to, you know, introduce a technology that fixes things somehow, like the Rotato, right? So what's the Rotato that's gonna stop the apocalypse? I mean, The Rotato was definitely what we call a disruptive technology, okay? The Rotato took, it took like, I've never used a knife since Lori bought me a Rotato for Christmas one year. You know, it was a game-changing technology. And if you don't believe that, okay, we're all familiar with other types of disruptive technologies. I mean, we hear this word a lot. Who recognizes that thing? It's a pager, right? From maybe the 90s. Doctors use it. My mom, she was a nurse on the like medevacs in Manitoba. They had pagers. For you kids, your drug dealers use those pagers, right? And then at some point, a disruptive technology came along. And then there's many arguments. It was us. It was the BlackBerry. Instead of paging your drug dealer, you could text them or email them. You know, it changed everything for us. It was amazing, right? But it was really a disruptive technology, and it came out of Waterloo. It was amazing, right? It changed the way the world works. And then, of course, other things came along, right? I don't know what you do. You Snapchat your drug dealer. I don't know what you do. I have no idea. But that was another disruptive technology. The iPhone was another disruptive technology. And you know, business leaders and economists, they use this language all the time because these disruptive interruptions in technology are really what kind of opens new markets and so on. And so there's something at stake for those guys. You know, there's something at stake because there's a lot of money to be made if you can identify the future disruptive technologies. And I pulled this off this McKinsey Global Institute like year-end report or something. Disruptive technologies, what they define them as is advances that will transform life, business, the global economy. I mean, it's economic. It's transformations that will profit somebody. And that's it. But if you look at this list of things, okay, it makes sense. There's a lot of things up there that I guess you could imagine having in kind of the short term, a fully mobile internet. Automation. This Internet of Things where you're like, your fridge is on the internet. I don't know why you need that, but your fridge, your weigh scale like shames you and it talks to your fridge. And it like locks your fridge when you've gained too much weight. That's the Internet of Things, right? I mean, people want this for some reason. Advanced robotics. Self-driving, that'd be all right. Although apparently they can't handle snow, so, they're completely useless after the apocalypse. Some of these things I haven't even heard of. Energy storage, advanced, now we're getting to what we do, advanced material. Lots of these things have some quantum component I haven't really talked about, but there's some quantum materials component in a lot of this stuff, because that's kind of the level that we're at this technology. But you can tell this is an economic document, because you like fracking's on there, right? So I mean, that was a disruptive technology in the oil sector, right? It just several years ago, when they basically got that technology working, that's what plunged oil prices, and that's why we're now going to pay for all the EI that's being claimed in Alberta. No, okay. Renewable energy. We're going to talk about that, but so these are disruptive sort of economic things. So what we need is not, we're scientists, or I don't know what we are. We're trying to stave off the apocalypse. We need disruptive technologies, and I claim those are quantum mechanical. Okay. It's disruptive quantum technologies that are going to actually help us out. So now what we're going to do, we're going to go through all your favorite apocalypse scenarios, and I'm going to tell you how quantum materials technology is going to save us. And because I don't know how to go out of order, I'm just going to go in the order that I made the slides, regardless of whether or not it's your favorite apocalypse scenario. So. My favorite one, which will get rid of those pesky polar bears, is global climate change. The Earth is on fire. How do we put the fire out? Okay, this is the fun one. So this one's been around for a while, and there's a really promising technology on the horizon that we all work on in my field of physics, which is condensed matter physics, and it's superconductors. And this is 1911. This is a plot from Kamerlingh Onnes in 1911 that shows the risk. I didn't label my, oh my God, my advisor would fire me. I didn't label my axes, but this is temperature, presumably in Kelvin or something, and this is resistivity, and this is the resistance, just like in a wire, the resistance of mercury as it gets cooled by liquid helium. It goes through some temperature where the resistance drops to zero. That's called superconductivity. That's a fundamentally quantum phenomena, and if you make a wire out of mercury, which is a liquid, if you put a current through mercury in this regime here, there's no resistance at all. It's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing. If we could get this to work, in all of our electronics, everything we do would be different. Everything. This is a slide from the Department of Energy in the US. So Seamus Davis, who's a friend of mine, gave a talk here, a colloquium, and he showed this slide, and he's the head of the Department of Energy's, you know, panel on emergent superconductivity. I forget what it's called. But the US government's funding this stuff quite a bit, and so is Canada through CIFAR and other places. And we work on this stuff with our grant money too. So everyone's funding superconductors because they're so amazing. They can essentially make wires and electronics run perfectly efficient, you know, without any losses. And you know that then you can build entirely new grids, like grids of like the hydro grid that has no losses at all. And this would be a huge efficiency gain. I mean, orders of magnitude. Also, one of the what I learned from Seamus is that one of the problems with using renewables is that renewables have to be on the desert somewhere, you know, where the sun shines, not like here. And then you have to pipe the electricity into Waterloo through these very long conductors, and there's bottlenecks in that process. And superconductivity can completely change that bottleneck scenario. So we can distribute our power generation in entirely different ways. Superconductivity, we can build windmills that are perfectly efficient. Like because the persistent currents, there's no resistance. You set a current up, it flows forever. We can change the way computers work. Next generation high energy physics. All right, who cares? Who cares about high energy physics, man? We're talking about real problems, real things, this apocalypse. So medical imaging, this is actually a really good one. And transport. Everyone talks about transport. And this is kind of a fascinating byproduct. I mean, it's kind of cool to think about revolutionizing the power grid and so on, and reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and all that stuff. But we could zip around in like levitating trains, man. That's what I want to do. And what's the connection between superconductivity and levitating trains? That's why Lauren's here. All right, let's make this connection. Welcome, Lauren Hayward. As you can see by the path of destruction up here, the trial run was interesting. What they're doing is they're cooling down a brick of one of these superconductors. We broke one, but maybe is it YBCO or it's one of these ones, underneath the boiling temperature of liquid nitrogen. Just like that mercury plot jumped down at some point. This is year of discovery. This is material. We have to get below a certain temperature in order to get a superconductor. And this is like the crazy thing with superconductivity. Oh, wow, that looks pretty good. Well, you can't, I don't know. My webcam's a little blurry, but Lauren, explain what's going on while you, not to distract you from this.
Okay, so we have, on the bottom, we have a material that's capable of superconducting at low temperatures, and on top, we just have a magnet. So we're going to cool everything down to a low temperature using liquid nitrogen. We can wait a minute or so. I know it's hard to see. Once it gets cool enough, we should see that this magnet starts to levitate. Because in addition to being able to conduct electricity with zero resistance, superconductors also expel magnetic fields. So we have a magnet. It contributes some kind of a magnetic field, but the superconductor wants to expel these magnetic fields. And so that's why it's going to start to levitate about here. So it's starting to work.
Oh my god, it's working!
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
look, he's not sure. I think it'll go a bit higher.
Oh, I can't believe it worked. Okay. Anything else to say?
The reason it stays so stably is because in these kind of superconductors, you can pin some of the magnetic flux in a specific location and you generate some currents in that are fixed in place. And so that's why this kind of superconductor.
But do you have to keep it cool all the time to do that, though?
Yeah, once it, you'll see that once it heats up, if you come look at this later, then it won't it won't stay like that.
We'll fall down.
Yeah.
And there it goes.
Yeah.
Isn't
that
crazy?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Oh.
Oh. Awesome. It's a plane crash. Thank you, Lauren.
Oh, my God. That was amazing. That worked so much better than the trial run. That's a good question because, you know, we're cooling it down somehow. We're cooling down the superconductor. It's like we're going through this this transition, they call it here. And you have to get below that temperature for everything to superconduct. But we're not going to be cooling down the whole world with liquid nitrogen, right? And that's the point. It's just like... but that's literally the point of our research on this topic, is that we need to find ways of, as the years progress, we keep pushing this upper, you know, is this Kelvin? Yeah, this is Kelvin, right? I don't even know what is room temperature in Kelvin? 273? Yeah. We got a long way to go, right? Like a long, long way to go. And it's not even clear that like the fundamental theories that we have in place for these superconductors can do anything to help us, you know. It's not clear we understand anything about these superconductors. And you know, they're a really complicated quantum material. That's basically the bottom line. So, but if, you know, if we can figure this out, levitating trains, man. That's, you know, it's amazing. All right. That was fun. Now let's get less fun. Global warming is a real thing, obviously. And this would contribute to, you know, to helping us solve the problem of essentially energy distribution, all sorts of. It's not going to solve all the problems associated with greenhouse gases, but it would be transformative. It'd be a disruptive technology. Let's go to some of my other favorite apocalypse scenarios. A sick world. The world is sick. You know, pandemics. You know, we fly all over the place. I don't know where I. I've been flying all over. I go to Texas on like Sunday. I can't even keep track of where I am. I'm coughing on everybody all the time. You know, they're coughing on me. It's just, everyone's catching colds and stuff. So what happens if one of these flu viruses mutates and becomes airborne and kills us all? That's a pandemic. Global systems collapse. How is that even related at all? You know, how is the stability of the internet related to any of this? Well, or say the food distribution system or anything like that. Well, these are all networks. And, you know, we also... In our sort of research, study quantum network theory. And quantum network theory, like other network theories, is just the theory of interactions of all of these quantum particles, you know, that these electrons or other types of quantum particles that could be moving around in these materials. So what's a network, you know? Well, it's like this thing I mentioned, this sort of global network of, let's say, I don't know, you know, maybe airplane, maybe this is like a connections between people. These are your friends, you know. You're a red dot. This guy's got one friend or something, you know. Poor guy, probably lives in Manitoba. This guy's got many friends. You know, he lives in Waterloo. There's lots of people here. And of course, then along came the internet and Twitter. And then now this represents a Twitter network. This is all your friends on Twitter. And it should be, you know, it's much, much more connected and so on. So this network theory applies to all of these complex systems that we've built. I mean, things like the banking system, things like the distribution networks, things like the internet, all this stuff, people study the sort of like coarse-grained or simplified networks of these things. And what people have discovered is they have a very difficult time telling how nodes on the network are correlated. How are we correlated? How do you and I interact? I mean, I have a Twitter, I follow you on Twitter, but I, you know, don't follow you on Twitter, or I follow you both on Twitter, but I'm more susceptible to agree with things that you say, but not you. All these correlations are very difficult to study, and they're not really part of the network connectivity. They're part of what they call the correlations in the networks. And there's a huge field of study on correlations in networks. And actually, correlations in networks are almost completely similar to correlations that we study in materials. And the only difference is that our networks, they're not people talking on the Twitters. It's like atoms with interactions that form a crystal lattice, say, or they form a fluid or something like that. I wrote an equation. I think I should have an equation in this talk. I don't know what that is. It's S. It's the correlations in that network. It's a thing we study somehow, right? So we can actually take our intuition from the very advanced quantum correlation theories that we developed for networks And we can translate them into all sorts of networks all over the world. And one amazing example is a measure that we use all the time, called for the experts. It's called entanglement entropy and mutual information. We can take that quantum correlation and we can translate it into these real-world classical networks. And one of these networks where this is very interesting and has been studied recently is in the stock market. And people have used these measures to look at correlations between different indices or different different quantities that people trade, derivatives and stuff like that. And this is the mean mutual information. It's one of these interesting correlation quantities as a function of date going from 95 up to the publication of this paper in 2009. And so again, this is something that we would use to study, that phase transition. The phase transition that turned that thing into a superconductor, I would use this quantity to study properties of that phase transition. Somebody else uses that same quantity, this blue line, I guess it's this S, I don't know what it is, to study the market. And there's amazing correlations in these things that the authors of this study have pointed out. And there's basically peaks that occur. So things are getting more correlated. The market's getting more and more correlated. There's more interactions between people in the stock market when these peaks are higher and higher. And these two events here are peaks that occurred right before market crashes in 97. The mutual information peaked, and then the correlations peaked. People started talking, they crashed, This one here is the onset of the subprime mortgage lending fiasco in the States. It basically made a huge peak in the stock market and then subsequently crashed in 2008. That's like August 2008. And by the time this paper came out, you see a huge growth in correlation again before 2009. And I don't think anyone's looked at this type of correlator after this study. So it's interesting how these peaks, it's like the market becomes more and more correlated. People start understanding the quantities that they're trading and the interactions, and they start becoming more and more complex. And then the system becomes unstable and the market crashes. This is 9/11. It was an exterior phenomenon here that didn't really do too much for the markets, just stagnated a bit. And kind of what's interesting about this paper is what they're studying is there's a huge market peak, a huge mutual information peak around 2002 or 2003 that doesn't correspond to any market crash. So some people believe this is something to do with some sort of indices that were traded in Russia at that time, but it's very complicated. There's things in the market you definitely don't understand. And this is just like a tiny little window into what's going on. It's fascinating. By the way, isn't this scary? Yeah. This thing's going up, man, and it's just going up. And it's like, how many years? Somebody should look at this again. If I wasn't so lazy, I would actually do some work and look at this index again. Maybe it flattened out. I don't know. Maybe that was a little too esoteric. Maybe that connection between quantum materials research and staving off the apocalypse. Maybe. You might be like, maybe I don't quite believe that. Okay, let's do a completely concrete one. And it's one that really bothered me when I was making this talk, man. What do I know about asteroids? How am I going to solve this asteroid striking the Earth problem? I don't know. It's a cosmological cataclysm. Is that even a word? I can solve this problem with quantum materials. I know I can do it, man. And so I decided, what do I know about asteroid hits? Well, I'm a condensed matter theorist, I'm not an astronomer, but I did watch Armageddon. And everything I know about asteroids hitting the Earth, I learned from Armageddon. Remember Armageddon? Remember? So it's like, they're out in space, and this is the zero barrier. And if the asteroid gets inside the zero barrier, it doesn't matter if we blow it up, it's still going to hit the Earth. And I even went on the internet, and I downloaded the script. And Bruce Willis is like, they say we have until zero barrier. Oh, and so they get the drilling rig out, and then they're drilling. And it's like, it's a big difficult drilling operation, and the first drill bit only goes 10 feet before it explodes, man. And they're like, we're all professional drillers. We've seen these drill bits, we're not after 10 feet, we only have one more drill bit. And then thank God, Bruce Willis, and he dies, and the asteroid, they get the bomb in there, and it blows the asteroid and just barely misses the zero barrier, remember, man? And then they're like, what a close call. God, lucky that second drill bit was made out of graphene, man. Yeah. That wasn't actually in the script. No, man, it wasn't. But it should have been, because graphene is the strongest material known to man. If that tip was made of, the first one was made of graphene, he never would have had a problem. Graphene is like the quantum strength threshold for material. It's the strongest thing you can imagine. It's two-dimensional, essentially, you know, carbon atoms arranged in this lattice. And if a sheet of saran wrap, I didn't know the generic term, which typically has a thickness of around 100 micrometers, where the same strength as graphene, basically you wouldn't, if you put your car on it, it wouldn't break the sheet of saran wrap. But if you put your car on a pencil, then that pencil would puncture that thing. That's how strong graphene is, man. This stuff, we gotta start making, you know, drill tips out of this stuff. I'll talk more about graphene. I really like graphene. And you know what? I was thinking about it. Now that I've solved the asteroid strike, I can also solve the impending, you know, nuclear war that's gonna happen. Well, you know, we've been doing it all along. We've been using graphene to keep our Russians busy. Isn't that a great, you know, it's true, right? Deem has been working on graphene for a year, you know, and Anton Berkov, you don't know, he's got the next graphene. You know, the Russians are fascinated with graphene. If we keep them busy, they're not gonna make the bombs, right? It's thank you, Perimeter, man. It's amazing. And if they do get distracted from their research and they do start making the bomb, and we start getting worried, graphene can still solve the nuclear war. We can build a space elevator, which, you know, a space elevator is an elevator in geosynchronous orbit, and that cable has to be so strong that only graphene, only carbon is, you know, basically diamond threads are the thing that people are talking about space. And we can just get off the planet. You know, let them blow it up, right? Graphene solves that problem too. I mean, graphene's amazing. All right, problem solved. And as I've been admittedly tongue-in-cheek, you know, looking at some of these apocalypse scenarios, you've probably seen, you know, the problem's us, right? Maybe, number one, we're causing the problem. Okay, right. But number two, we can't count. And number three, maybe we're the bottleneck. And it's not just that we're causing the problems, but those of us trying to solve the problems, you know, it's highly likely that we're not smart enough to solve the problems. It's just like we're monkeys with clothes, literally. It's just like I'm always trying to teach my dog calculus. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many hours I spend with her. She'll never, you know, she'll never be able to integrate. She'll never become a scientist. It's really disappointing. But you know, we can solve this problem by creating brains that are smarter than ours. And some people believe, maybe not me, but this is the way we should be going, is with artificial intelligence, you know? But why, how is artificial intelligence going to solve this problem of us destroying the world, right? Well, in some sense, AIs are the ultimate disruptive technology. I mean, you don't even really have to, like, pick a scenario where they help you. They just help you in all scenarios, you know? Number one, which is important, infrastructure. Where's my flying car, you know? Like, since the 80s, I've wanted a flying car, and there's no flying. I've given up on people. They're not going to make a flying car. We need the AIs to make a flying car. I mean, it's obvious, right? All the infrastructure, all of our power grids, all of our network designs, immediately, Obama versus Putin, they're never going to agree, right? But the AI can mediate that very logically and you know, tell them exactly what they should do to settle their arguments. Man, have you ever really thought about why it's not E equals MC3? Have you ever really thought about it? You don't have to, because the AI will do it for you, man. It's amazing. Like, just, you know, the AIs can do they can do my job. Then I wouldn't have to come in to this, you know, my awful office looking over the lake. It's so tedious. And this is my favorite. They could provide us with a way to upload ourselves into a virtual reality world. And then, you know, we've released our pressure on the resources of the Earth. We can live in the computer trading bitcoins and, like, playing World of Warcraft. And all we have to do is plug into a hydro dam somewhere. Let the AIs, you know, worry about the Earth, steward the world while we live in our, you know, Ulysses of artificial intelligence. Why not? You know, let's just do it. So a lot of people work on AI. A lot of people less sort of insane than me work on AI. So you're safe in a way. There's legitimate scientists working on this stuff. And a lot of AI development occurs in software. And, you know, people initially studied neural networks and all sorts of interesting, like, sort of programming software-related issues for AI. And they've translated into real-world uses that we use all the time today. And one of the most famous, somehow, is facial recognition technology. You use it all the time. I mean, I'm not on the internet, but if I was on Facebook, presumably people are getting tagged via their face, right? I think iPhoto does it, the Apple one. I mean, it can be done offline. It's been quite a disruptive technology in some sense in terms of identifying people's face. And how it works, very simply, is you basically lay a grid over somebody's photo, and you look at specific parameters on that grid, like distance between their eyes, distance between their mouth, and the corners of their mouth, and their nose. And there's a whole bunch of these little vertices that they enter into, basically like a grid, like an array, just something you feed into the computer. Comparisons are made. This is the AI software. It actually does, it's called machine learning. The machine learns by looking at many faces, which faces are who. So when you tag yourself online, if you've done it on many photos, machine learning comes along, learns your parameters, and then applies that to other photos that might not be tagged by you. That's how machine learning works. Incidentally, that's why I grew that beard. Because if you don't know the vertices of your mouth and your nose in this relationship, these AI programs have a real problem identifying you on the internet. So I recommend all of you do the same thing. Is that true, Lori? It is true. It is true. I know. Oh my God. I grow up for looks too, but also the AI. Anyway, but should I be worried? Is it just government software tracking me, which I understand because, you know, governments are like that? Or is some sort of self-aware cyborg tracking me on the internet? Well, I don't even know, right? And I was worried about this last night, so I asked my phone. I said, Siri, are you artificial intelligence? And then it was like a very HAL type answer. It's like, I'm afraid. So either the phone knows that I know, and it's, you know, or the phone doesn't know. But I don't know. So that just sent me into a spiral of doubt. But I believe what it means is actually that the AI has a long way to go. You know, we have these algorithms. We have a lot of AI type algorithms, but the machine learning process is quite hard, actually. And believe it or not, the bottleneck, I don't believe, is the algorithms or the software. These have been under development for decades. It's the actual hardware itself. I mean, that phone is very, very powerful. You know, my laptop is it's amazingly powerful the way they make these things. But it's still not powerful enough to take all of those different algorithms and put them together into like a real thinking machine. And that's, as my phone illustrated, it's maybe decades off. And it's not only just the fact that we can like extrapolate our current industrial process for making these chips into some future where we have the technology or the hardware that'll support an AI. That's not necessarily possible from what we understand about sort of the physics of semiconductors. And don't take my word for it. You know, the senior VP of IBM, I forget what year this was, we really do see the clock ticking in silicon. Silicon's your chip. He's really saying that their industrial process for making microprocessors, they can see the end of it. Actually, Intel, which has been the most successful sort of company in making our chips faster in a sense. And so what does faster mean? It means clock speed. You ever buy it's like 2 gigahertz, 1-point-something gigahertz, maybe 3 gigahertz, these chips have a floating point operation speed. That thing's been stagnant for like 10 years, if you've noticed, or maybe not quite 10 years, but the number of floating point operations is basically the same. They just pack more and more transistors onto the chips. And Intel's been very successful in that, but even they are saying, we can't keep doing this, you know? There's an end in sight for how many chips we can pack on a computer. And their roadmap is quite clear. It's back in 2005, like 10 years ago, a transistor made by Intel that was in production was of size 65 nanometers, okay, just some small size. They've shrunk these down, so as clock speed sort of like plateaued, your computer didn't get like faster, they just put more and more of these logical transistors, these bits, you know, classical bits, onto the chip. And they're working on, from sources on the inside, I know they're working on the 7-nanometer die shrink now, but after that, it's not clear that you can get any smaller. Number one, quantum effects are getting quite large. And these aren't maybe the good quantum effects. These are somehow the decohering quantum effects. You know, the size of the atoms are only maybe 35 or 40 times smaller than the transistor that they make out of the junctions with the atoms. I mean, there's a definite atomic limit to where this is going. And once it hits the end, these chips that we use will basically plateau in their power. So, you know, you've enjoyed your phone getting more and more powerful. How long can that last? They say maybe 10 years. The end of Moore's law will be in 10 years, something like that, right? So that's scary, you know. It's like Siri's not going to get all that much better or something like that. My fridge and my scale, maybe they're not going to be able to talk all that efficiently without these high efficiency chips. So, you know, this is the biggest problem I think that we're facing, honestly, is that our economic and our sort of like internet systems are made such that they accommodate this increasing, they need this to accommodate this increasing hardware power all the time. And people are scared, and people are looking at different solutions. And again, graphene or carbon nanotubes, basically a rolled up sheet of graphene, has been one of the sort of most promising areas that people have looked at. The idea is to make a transistor out of a tiny little carbon nanotube that's laid down between some gates and all sorts of other issues. Just laid down in an engineering way to take advantage of the sort of interesting quantum structures of the electronic dispersion. But you know, this is a very sort of like prototype technology. They haven't been able to scale this in any way. They can make these small devices, but they can't put bazillions of them on a chip. So maybe they're saying IBM chips made with nanotube transistors, which probably also have sort of a lower end in how small they can get. Maybe they'll be ready in 2020. So maybe they'll be ready just in time for the death of silicon. Although some people are skeptical because the silicon production process started in the 50s. So I don't know, 1954, 55 or something like that to today. So that's a long time for industry to ramp up, you know. So there's not much of an industry yet. We work essentially on this problem, but maybe, you know, for years after 2020, we're talking about, you know, what other types of quantum properties are lurking at this microscopic scale? Is there other types of materials that will support, you know, very microscopic bits? Or are there even other quantum degrees of freedom like the spins, you know? The electrons have charge and spin. Maybe the spin transistors made with the spintronics will solve all of these problems. I mean, so there's a lot of sort of deep thinking going on, not by me, but by my students and postdocs on this type of problem. So the final thing I just want to mention is the elephant in the room on this computing stuff is quantum computing. Okay, a lot of us will think that, you know, we're at Waterloo. We're actually working on this problem. We have a quantum computing institute. Many of us in condensed matter and at Perimeter and so on work on this problem of quantum computing. And it's true. This is one of the most exciting problems in physics. My group works on a type of qubit, so a quantum bit that's not the transistor. You know, it's the next level technology that is sort of a donut. They call it a Tor code. It stabilizes a qubit against decoherence, which is the big problem in quantum computing. Sorry, this isn't a quantum computing talk, so I'm just saying jargon. But we work on all sorts of aspects with quantum computing. But you have to take the devil's advocate position and think, you know, quantum computing is not a general solution to our computing woes, our upcoming slowing downs or our plateauing of computer. Quantum computing gives us a set of very specific algorithms that may be faster if we can get the hardware scaled up big enough. And that's a long, very long-term, very difficult approach that people are taking. These very few specific algorithms, incidentally, include one algorithm called Shor's algorithm, which factors numbers into primes. Very mathematical somehow. But that's the thing that a lot of people have latched onto in quantum computing, because there's a very specific application, and that's breaking RSA encryption. So when you talk over the internet, you know, everything's encrypted with public keys, and those public keys are protected by a huge number that's two prime numbers. And if you can factor that number, you can break the code. That's how the entire encryption system works. And people are very interested in breaking this encryption scheme, because then they can read all classical communications. And just to be paranoid, you know, when Snowden released his black budget, there was $11 billion annually. There's a huge budget, 50-something billion dollars a year, sorry. But part of that, like basically, you know, a fifth of the black budget for the NSA alone was just for decryption. Okay, and 4% of that was R&D, or research and technology. And a portion of that was quantum computing. Because, you know, it's one of many approaches the NSA is taking. This type of funding trickles down in a huge way. Right? As soon as there's one problem for a technology like this that's as sort of, you know, interesting to these types of people as breaking these RSA encryptions, a ton of money flows into this thing. It's basically a defense thing, right? We all benefit from, hey, I'm not complaining, you know, we all benefit from this type of money. But I think we have to be aware, just to end on this note, that the general hardware that we need to build an AI can't be entirely quantum, okay? It has to be part quantum and part, you know, classical, part this silicon replacement. And if we can keep both of these infrastructures going in terms of research, Maybe we have a chance to build my friend the AI. Anyway, that's it. The threat is complex. I don't even know all the different amazing apocalypse scenarios that I read in these documents. But you know, the challenge, although highly technical, we have the team of geniuses right here, some of them in this room that can solve this for us, the students. So thank you guys very much. You've been fun.
I was wondering if you had any tips for the ladies who are trying to avoid the government on beard growing.
You know, Harper made wearing masks at protests illegal, so you're screwed there. And that was why. It's so they can take facial recognition software. They can take pictures of people running through facial recognition software. So we can grow beards, but ladies, I'm sorry.
Makeup?
Maybe a lot of makeup, yeah.
Maybe change
the corners of everything.
A big fake mouth, I don't know. I recommend it. I hope to see all of you with that type of makeup soon.
Roger, how'd you start from Northern Manitoba and end up coming here, being a physicist? I'm assuming not many physicists come out of Northern Manitoba.
Not that I know of. Not in the population density of less than one person per square mile. No. I came here for undergrad. And honestly, what attracted me here in part was co-op, because I was, we're 18 when we graduated in Manitoba at the time. There was actually grade 13 here. I didn't know about it, but I came here essentially for co-op because I had to work my way through university. It's a really nice program. You know, you do 4 months of school, 4 months of work, 4 months, you know. And so basically, co-op was a big part of it. I looked at other schools in Canada, but that was the sort of deal, the deal breaker was co-op. Yeah.
You talked a little bit about timeline of when we might see some commercializations, but when, you know, some of these technologies we talked about, when will they be, you know, commercial products that I could buy, or, you know, superconducting wires or you know, in the kind of mainstream commercial?
Yeah, so stuff like superconductors, there's no time frame, even though I put a time frame up for that. There's no time frame for when the breakthrough has to happen where this thing jumps to room temperature. Although that being said, let me just mention that room temperature is much colder in Manitoba, so we're actually winning the race for room temperature superconductors. But anyway, like, you know, we need a fundamental breakthrough. That's why physicists are working on it, not engineers. If we're, you know, some of the Intel problem, that's an engineering problem essentially. Although, I mean, honestly, physicists work on it too. But that's not what I would call like a perimeter type problem. Like here, you know, the roadmap up to 7 nanometers is essentially an engineering problem. But to get high temperature superconductors up to room temperature, we need something transformative. We need new physics. And I didn't mention it, but the problem isn't sort of just technical necessarily. The problem is with the fundamental theories that go into quantum mechanics. It's like, I don't think we've structured the theories correctly. So physics has to be revamped in some way possibly. And it's a very complicated thing. And that's why perimeter is so amazing, because, you know, we talk to sort of the quantum gravity people about, you know, and the field theory and the quantum information people, and we're all working on the same underlying foundation, right? But then at top, there's a lot of different applications. And so I've sort of just talked about applications here.
Do those guys in the U.S. talk at all? Like, are you able to collaborate with those guys in the U.S. who are working on it and are funded by governments?
That's kind of interesting. So there are labs in the U.S. that are, and there's people in Canada that are also funded directly by the NSA, actually. But there's also labs, so IBM in New York, the Watson lab that we're associated with somehow, they have a big quantum computing group. And then Microsoft, I just visited there last week as a quantum computing group, which gets money from different sources. But I think Argonne National Lab has a quantum, and Los Alamos has a quantum computing. But people also suspect that there's a group of NSA scientists that don't publish, that live in the government. Yeah. And they believe that because, you know, they have to come through academia, right? They have to learn all this high-level quantum theory. Then at some point, they get poached out of groups when they're basically at the postdoc level. So some of the really good, yeah, and you never see them. They never publish, okay? I guess that's like seeing them for us, right? They might go to conferences and something, but they'll never publish again. So there is a group of people that people believe work on this direct NSA quantum computing Shor's algorithm thing. It's so spooky, right?
If you're listening, I need a job.
So what do you think our kind of time frame is until we hit this stagnation point, until you guys come up with a whole new,
like, disruptive
breakthrough next level physics?
Like, you know, I think it's, on one hand, it seems slower and slower because the problems are so much harder. I mean, I didn't mention it, but we do all sorts of large-scale simulation. And so everything we do is on these huge-scale computers. You know, it's like we use the biggest computers that they can build to try to solve the quantum equations that we need to solve to fix these problems, right? And they can just barely, you know, it's just like we're barely keeping up somehow. But then on the other hand, just like the way science always works, is things pop out of nowhere that turn out to be completely disruptive. And like kind of graphene was one of those things. And that's why people like it. It's like 2004. And somebody figured out that if you take like a pencil, and you take scotch tape, and you pull scotch tape off the pencil tip, that graphene falls off. Perfectly two-dimensional graphene. Like, who would have thought, right? But that's kind of how the discovery process works. You kind of plow ahead on the things that you're interested in, and then somebody's like doing this with their pencil and gets a Nobel Prize. They got the Nobel Prize. So who knows, man?
How do you go about modeling quantum systems on classical machines?
That's a great question, and it's really hard, is the answer. And so there's a lot of ways to do it. So that's basically what we specialize in, is we take the quantum equations, and we have to put them on classical machines, but we have to modify. One of the most important things is the dimension of the system. If I want to study graphene, say, it's two-dimensional, but I need to like study in this three-dimensional abstraction that would occur on the computer. But not all quantum problems can be abstracted onto a classical computer. And that's also very fundamental somehow. We don't know why. And it seems like that class of things we can't study, including the microscopic theory for superconductivity, is the interesting class of things. So that's why we haven't solved the superconductor problem, I believe, is that we can't put it on a computer. You know, we can't take that microscopic quantum theory and solve it on a classical computer. So some things you can, some things you can't, you know.
How closely are you working with people in the chemistry department in terms of developing materials?
Very closely. I have a collaborator, Pierre Nicholas Waugh, who works in quantum chemistry. He does the same technique as me. He uses this type of computer simulation and extra dimensions, but he studies sort of quantum molecules, say. So it's also very interesting. You know, it's like this sort of, again, this fundamental quantum theory goes between many fields. So he's very interested in rotational modes of vibration in quantum molecules. But you know, I'm working on quantum networks and crystals and stuff. Like, it's very different, but the tools are the same. And you know, that's what I love about actually Waterloo is, at some point we were talking about our algorithms, and you know, we realized that we could really improve our algorithms. And a guy from actuarial sciences came to talk to me, like statistics, you know. And what he did was he did this type of market indicator stuff, you know, these marketing things. He was looking at somehow correlations in this type of classical system. And I realized that the algorithm that he uses can translate into my computer algorithms. And I actually, the same day, walked over here and I talked to Rob Myers about some gravity theory that we could simulate. And I put that thing in from like actuarial sciences, that algorithm, and I used it to work on some gravity theory with Rob Myers. So it's like complete technology transfer across disciplines. But like you need a place like Perimeter and Waterloo to kind of facilitate that. It's amazing, you know. And that's the best, you know, I should mention, that's the best part of the job. I mean, you know, I like this motivating things, you know. But in the end, you know, why did we trap antimatter? Oh, you know, we did it because it's fucking awesome, you know. All this stuff's awesome. Like, I love working on this stuff. I'm glad I saved that slide. Yeah. I'll accept that offer.